after World War II, at this point that some people call the Great Acceleration, consumption in the United States really just took off. People were really in the mood to have a consumer lifestyle. And there had also been these tremendous gains in industrial productivity. We went from there and we have really never slowed down.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack. So today we're delighted to have two well-informed experts, James McKinnon, best-selling Canadian author, and Vincent Stanley from Patagonia Clothing, to help us own up to our part in the global climate problem, namely our crazy consumption. The Day the World Stopped Shopping is the title of James McKinnon's latest book, which imagines what would happen to our economies, our planet, and ourselves if we bought less stuff. He proposes that if we could reduce our consumption by just 5%, it would make a big difference and we would barely notice the shift. So it's time to ask yourself, what are you willing to give up to save the planet? Well, welcome first to you, James, who's joining us from the University of Victoria. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Let's look at some of the facts that you quote in the book. For decades now, you say we've witnessed an almost non-stop increase in the consumption of every major resource, from oil to gemstones, gravel to gold. We're using up the planet at a rate 1.7 times faster than we can regenerate. In fact, if everyone consumed like the average American, it would be 5 times faster. We currently spend about $250 billion dollars a year just on digital gadgets. So two things. When did Americans become so needy, or should we say greedy? And when did this overconsumption start?
It's an interesting question because historians have gone back in time trying to find some precise point where even the human species became consumers, and they can find traces of our consumeristic type behaviors as far back as they care to reach. I mean, people were decorating hand axes not long after they invented hand axes, and they used the decorations presumably for the same kinds of uses we would, which is to show our taste and our individuality and maybe our status. But we certainly see in the 20th century a real acceleration in consumption, and particularly after World War II, at this point that some people call the Great Acceleration. That was the point at which consumption in the United States really just took off. And it probably happened for a couple of reasons. One was that in the decades previous to that, they'd had their consumption restrained. And so at the end of World War II, people were really in the mood to have a consumer lifestyle. And there had also been these tremendous gains in industrial productivity. So there was enormous, and technology, there was an enormous number of consumer goods available, and they were more affordable than ever. And people were in the mood to buy them. We went from there, and we have really never slowed down.
So the overconsumption hasn't been a kind of a recent thing since the 60s or the 70s?
Yeah, I mean, the people who are studying when consumption in the United States went out of balance with what is a sustainable amount of resource use at a planetary scale, say that the U.S. probably passed that point sometime between the 40s and 70s, but nobody's really certain when that happened. But what we know at a global scale, the UN panel that studies global natural resources says that around the year 2000, consumption became the biggest driver of our environmental crises. So a bigger driver even than the growing population of the planet's people. And if you have trouble picturing how that works, the statistic that helped me think about it is the idea that right now the average person in one of the world's richer countries consumes as much as 13 people in a poorer country. So if you picture a family of four in one of the world's richer countries, they're consuming as much as 54 people in a poorer country. And there's not a lot of 54 person families out there in any country. So you can really see how consumption is almost like a proxy for population. If you consume enough, it's as though you are consuming as a huge group of people.
So let's go back to this kind of concept of need versus greed. I wonder how much the corporate world has to take responsibility for ramming stuff down our throats, particularly feeding insecurities in the younger generation. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'm opening my computer this week and without my control getting pushed to buy the latest iPhone, which I don't want. And I didn't solicit that. So first of all, is that part of the problem, that they're not taking responsibility? And secondly, do you think stuff is a kind of substitute for connection in our lives now?
Going to the first one, I mean, who's responsible? I think it's really complicated. I mean, I think given the origins of consumption, for example, we look at planned obsolescence, like if we, this idea that products are designed to fail, if we look at the history of that, you would imagine that there was some point where an evil cabal of corporate heads got together and said, yeah, let's design things to break so that we can sell more and more of them. People have to replace those products. But if you look at the history of planned obsolescence, it's not really like that. There was a time when even, you know, leftist leaders and union leaders were saying, look, we have lots of resources and we have the capacity to produce a lot of goods. Let's do it. We don't want to produce goods that are too high quality because then people don't have to buy more and more of them and that won't strengthen the economy. This was something that people spoke about quite openly in the origins of planned obsolescence. But since then, we've understood what the ecological consequences of planned obsolescence are, and our attitudes have, you know, changed about that. I think that's true of many things. Like early in the development of consumption, I don't think people thought there was any harm in using advertising to push people to buy a lot of products. And it was only as we gradually learned about the consequences that it's become a lot more questionable. And so now I think the question is, you know, we know that driving people to consume is a very serious driver of environmental problems. And so now, how do advertising firms respond? How do corporations respond to the fact that this is what they participate in at this point? And how might they change? If you develop a consumer culture, then we use consumption for everything. We use it to show our love through gift giving. We use it to signal our identities through the choices we make and what we wear and drive and how we furnish our homes and all of these sorts of things. So I think as consumer culture has led to a disconnection between people, we have tried, and this is probably a feedback loop, but we have tried to fill up these states of disconnection with the joys of consumerism, because there is that dopamine hit that people get from buying a new thing and having it show up in a box and opening that box and pulling it out, all of those sorts of things. We've gotten very good at using consumption as a kind of proxy for real happiness and real life satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. So you said something interesting in the book. You said when people consume less stuff, we get immediate drops in emissions, resource consumption and pollution, unlike anything we've achieved with green technology, which was remarkable when I read that. So why are you not shouting this aloud at the COP26 conference?
Well, if they invited me, maybe I would. But I think the key point is that when I say this is just a plain truth. If we look at the increase in carbon emissions, then they climb all the way through the 20th and 21st centuries so far, with occasional mysterious dips. And those dips come around 1930. They come in the 1940s, the 1980s, mid 1980s, early 1990s, 2008, 2009, and the pandemic. So fans of history will recognize the pattern here, which is, on the one hand, those are all occasions when large numbers of people reduce their consumption, and it has this powerful effect on reducing carbon emissions, because every dollar spent in the consumer economy generates carbon emissions. The other thing all of those points have in common is that they were global disasters, wars, recessions, depressions, and the pandemic. So this is why this is a tough thing to shout from the rooftops, is because right now, you know, the evidence we have and the impression we have is that if we reduce our consumption, it results in an economic catastrophe. So the question becomes, how do we harness the benefits of reducing consumption without triggering collapse?
Okay, so that's a very interesting point, because everyone, as soon as you say we've got to cut back on shopping, they've got ideas. We're all going to go around like Fred Flintstone, you know, and that it's going to be dramatic. It's going to be, you know, horrific. It's going to be unbearable, because we're so ruined, basically, aren't we? We're spoilt rotten in the West. So how do you envisage this? How would this play out if, say, we just all cut back in 5%? That's very modest.
Yeah, I mean, 5% would be a good start, I think. And if we think about that at an individual level, for a lot of people, 5% would be literally unnoticeable. I mean, if you, people are buying twice as many clothes now as they did 20 years ago, they could cut the number of clothes down by 50%. And most people are not really going to be suffering. Most of the clothes we buy now don't make it through a year before they're disposed of. It would be pretty painless, I think, for most people to cut down their consumption, or many people certainly in a place like the United States, to cut their consumption by 5% or considerably more without having personal suffering of any real kind. The economy, however, would respond quite differently. And so that's where I think we need to look at what are the kinds of changes we can make in the system that allow us to move towards a lower consuming society and economy, but without it leading to disaster. And, you know, companies like Patagonia are, I think, providing some sense of what that might look like, you know, business models where there's less focus on growth. There's more attention paid to producing products that last and are durable and that create durable relationships with the products, focusing less on the production of new things and more on the circulation of already existing things, maintenance and repair. You know, there are all these other sectors that we might be able to revive that will still provide economic energy, but will allow us to reduce our consumption. Ultimately, do I think that means that we would end up with a smaller, slower churning economy? I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question, but I think the answer is probably yes, that we ultimately have to right size the economy to make it sustainable. But at the same time, I don't think that we have to go back to the Stone Age, right? I mean, we can create a much more sustainable economy without having to sink into the collapse of civilization, which I think a lot of people think is our only alternative.
Well, I'm going to say something here which might sound a bit kind of like reactionary, but the first thing you notice when you're a foreigner coming to the States, harkening back years ago when I came, is the excess factor. When you get here, you notice extraordinary sizes of food portions. You see all the stuff that gets thrown away, even at a dinner table or in a restaurant. You see an inordinate number of TV sets, tons of cars parked outside people's houses. And then this Christmas tree factor that I notice, where entire houses are lit up and offices with nobody in them. And I was struck that struck me as so odd. You know, it was this, there was this bottomless pit of stuff and it was all free. And you could just waste it. So I thought after the pandemic, you know, there might have been some sort of long lasting lessons from that. Were there any at all, or was it just this little blip?
I think early in the pandemic, something really important happened when people were locked out of consumer culture and before consumer culture had reoriented itself to allow, you know, open the doors to people to consume again. I think within that window, a lot of people did have an opportunity to revisit their values and priorities, and even just to get a bit of a breather from 24/7 commercial culture. So I should say, I mean, it's not really surprising that ultimately we went back to consumption. I mean, most of us now have grown up since birth as consumers in a consumer society. There are all kinds of powerful forces that encourage us to consume. It's what we know, you know, it's how we form our identities. As I said earlier, we use it for so many things that I think it was very easy for people to go back to the comfortable embrace of consumerism. But what I'm hearing certainly is that a lot of people are doing that this time with mixed feelings and with some ambivalence about returning to full throttle consumption.
I hope you're right. You're listening to Cambridge Forum's discussion of The Day the World Stopped Shopping with Canadian author J.B. McKibben and Vincent Stanley from Patagonia. So, suggestions about resetting the dial here for a moment. You mentioned voluntary simplicity in the book in Japan, the example you use. Could you tell us a little bit about what you meant by that?
Well, voluntary simplicity is a practice, really, of deliberately reducing your consumption. The half of it that's not usually talked about is that it's also a practice of shifting your value set from one that's centered on income and possessions and social status to one that's more focused on intrinsic values, as psychologists put it. And those are things like developing strong relationships with people you care about, or connecting with the natural world, participating in your community, mastering skills, developing a sense of an authentic personal identity. And a big one is becoming involved in issues that are larger than yourself, like social justice or the environmental movement, things like that. So if you look at people who practice voluntary simplicity, which I did, spoke to people in a number of countries around the world who've been practicing voluntary simplicity for decades. And that really is, that's in the absence of being able to take pleasure and meaning from consumer culture to the same degree, a lot of people invest more of their effort in these sorts of values. And the other thing that's interesting about this, of course, is that psychologists who study these value sets point out that materialistic values and consumeristic values don't tend to make us happy in the long run. And they don't provide us with that sense of well-being. And this other set of values does. So that's kind of if we imagine what a lower consuming lifestyle or world looks like, then it's probably one in which more of us invest more of our time and energy in the pursuit of those kinds of values. On the other hand, it's very difficult. You noted that people are starting to buy their clothing from thrift stores and things like that. That's quite a powerful trend right now. And Generation Z is quite a big part of that. But my own generation did that as well. I grew up in the 1990s in Vancouver, and particularly on the West Coast of North America, with grunge fashion and things like that. We were all shopping at thrift stores. We had uncooled consumerism. We were rejecting big corporate brands and swearing we were never going to drive an SUV. Most people, there are movements like this periodically throughout history. They don't succeed. At the height of that movement in the 1990s, one in five Americans was saying that they had reduced their consumption and they had done so happily. But that still leaves four out of five Americans that weren't doing that. So it's very difficult to spend your lifetime as an outsider in your own culture. And combine that with like a $600 billion advertising industry and all of the other forces that encourage us to consume. It's very difficult for us to do this as individuals. And that's why I think we need to look at these kinds of system level changes that can help make it easier for all of us to consume less. Changing the way we do business, changing something as simple as putting lifespan labeling on products so that when you pick up, two sweaters, and one is more expensive than the other, you can see, this one's more expensive in part because it's going to last 10 years and this one's going to last 10 wears, right? So if you think about those kinds of changes, they're concrete, real actions that we can take that will transform the actual system rather than loading it onto the individual to feel bad about, which is the approach we usually use.
So that's a very good point, because I was about to say, that certain government measures have worked very effectively in the past. People didn't like them, but like rationing after the Second World War worked super effectively. When I was around, I have to remember the 55 mile an hour fuel, speed limit. That worked very effectively to cut our oil consumption. People don't like them, but if they could treat the climate situation like the pandemic, with that sense of urgency.
This to me is really the crucial point, is that ultimately we consume a lot because we've created a system that strongly encourages us to consume a lot. If you think about it, it's kind of absurd for us to criticize even ourselves for being over consumers when that's our primary role in society. And when we slow down, when we don't do it, our presidents of nations and prime ministers of countries will come out and actually ask you to get back and go shopping. Obama did it. George W. Bush did it. Tony Blair did it. they will incentivize, you know, they will, if enough people stop shopping, they will cut checks and send money to households to spend. So we shouldn't be shocked that in a consumer society, we end up as consumers. We should transform the consumer society into something different. And we can do that, I think, incrementally through these sorts of concrete actions. So lifespan labeling is just one example, but you see things like Sweden has drastically reduced taxation on repairs so that it becomes more likely that a person's going to get a product repaired than to replace it. If you combine that with something like right to repair legislation, which President Biden has actually spoken of, in which companies would be mandated to produce things that could be repaired in many more circumstances than they are today, you start to see how an actually different kind of economy starts to emerge, where people are buying things that they keep for a longer period of time and they maintain and repair them because that's the economically sensible thing to do. And you can make transformations like that at in kind of every sector of society.
Yeah, there are a number of very sustainable cities around the world. I mean, Amsterdam is actually one of them. And I think it's now not possible to buy a new pair of jeans in Amsterdam. You have to buy recycled, repurposed denim. And they collect jeans from people and then reconstitute them. So I just think that's a great concept. When people realize how much damage is done to the environment to produce one pair of jeans, maybe they would rethink, do I actually have to have? And then they'll pay an exorbitant price to get a used looking pair of jeans.
But I mean, I think this, again, I'm always supportive of these kinds of efforts to reduce the impacts of the things we buy, for example, by making sure that the jeans are made with recycled products. But there's still the mindset that's a concern, right? That if we're buying an ever greater number of recycled jeans, you know, we're still not really getting anywhere. We've probably slowed down our impacts, but the impacts are still going to accumulate over time until we start to hit some kind of sense of sufficiency around jeans. You know, how many jeans do we need in a household? Exactly. Start to come to some sort of social agreement around what an absolutely absurd amount of jeans is and what, you know, what's a reasonable pair number of pairs of jeans to have in a lifetime. Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to get some of those things sorted out through legislation or anything like that. But I think we get to that kind of a place more through actually having a cultural conversation around overconsumption and its impacts. And we really haven't, the conversation around the actual impacts of the sheer volume of consumption hasn't been a part of mainstream public discourse for about 25 years. And it's, you know, it's really time that we start talking not only about how to green things, but actually how to reduce consumption, and particularly in sustainability circles, which have been so focused for the last 20 years on how to green away the impacts of our consumerism rather than reducing our actual consumption.
Okay, well, this is a very good point, I think, to switch over to Vincent Stanley and include Vincent in the discussion. Vincent's had very long associations with a very innovative clothing company, which probably everybody knows, Patagonia. And they have embraced pretty radical practices for a retailer over the years, encouraging customers away from the throwaway idea and buy less but better. Apparently, 10% of the annual global carbon emissions originate from the fashion industry. How many of these purchases do you think, Vincent, end up in the bin? And what is the average lifespan? James said earlier it was 10 wears or something, or was it even less?
You know, I think it's about 9 times for fast fashion, but more for regular clothes. But to me, one of the second part of that shocking figure is that the clothes are then just thrown away. Not recirculated, not given to Goodwill. But going back to James's point, I think it's one of the things that we've been talking about for several years is how do you change the relationship of a manufacturer to what we, the clothes we make, but also as a consumer, how do we change our relationship to things? Because if you have that dopamine moment, the moment at which that piece of clothing means the most to you is when you put your your credit card across the cash and wrap, that's just an invitation to a cycle of dissatisfaction and waste. So how do you change the relationship so that you honor the things that you actually buy, you keep them a long time, they're good in the first place, you repair them? So we've talked about that quite a bit, and I think that that has begun to enter the conversation. There's one other thing I'd like to talk about, just about the consumption in America, which is really quite distinct. There's something, consumer contributions to the economy are at 70% in the United States, and it's about 50% on average in Europe, which means that those countries are spending far more on social services. The government is a bigger part of what creates the economy. It's something that we might be thinking about as we face not only an environmental crisis, but we're facing an environmental and a social crisis, because the levels of inequality have also grown, particularly in this country, to the point where I think you have about one third of the population, probably the three of us on this panel, who are doing, okay, we can actually live a life that we fairly intend to, but about two thirds of the people are stuck in lives that are not quite at all what they intended or providing economic satisfaction, those without a college degree. So what you have is you have this disproportionate level of consumption in the United States within the economy that creates the kind of frenzy and the kind of waste that you noticed when you came over from Europe. And then within the United States, that spending is highly disproportionate among about a third of the population. So how do we bring that into the conversation as well? It's not a question of reducing consumption as much as it is of adopting a more sane approach to life, one that does bring satisfaction and one that does address this extraordinary social and environmental crisis that now manifests itself in different ways in every year. It isn't episodic anymore, it's chronic. And we can't look away from that. We have to deal with it. And in the process, as James pointed out, when we've had consumption drop at points of disaster, we're going to be facing more of those moments. So how do we figure out how we're going to adapt our lives so that we can mitigate those harms and at the same time open up our lives to something that doesn't involve consumption and transactions for so much of the day?
Thanks to James McKinnon and Vincent Stanley and to all of you for joining us in today's discussion on the day the world stopped shopping. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, the City of Cambridge, and you. So please step up and donate via our website, www.cambridgeforum.org, where you'll find a podcast of this and other forums, as well as details of past programs. In addition to our weekly NPR broadcast, a video of this will be available shortly on GBH Forum Network via YouTube. Please sign up on our website to receive details of upcoming programs, and the next forum will be on eco-anxiety, promise and peril in the age of climate crisis. Please join us for the discussion. Bye for now.